KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana tribal leaders say the health of their people hinges on whether lawmakers renew the state's Medicaid expansion program. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
If state lawmakers don't act, nearly 14,000 indigenous Montanans could lose health coverage under Medicaid expansion. When legislators renewed the program in 2019, they implemented a sunset for mid-2025. There are two bills in the legislature that would make the program permanent. Another would end expansion. Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Councilmember Jennifer Finley told lawmakers Medicaid expansion is a vital lifeline in tribal communities.
It provides economic growth on every reservation in Montana with the creation of jobs. At the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Health, this has meant tribal members that follow their dream to become doctors, pharmacists, can return home to provide much-needed services to our people, which builds confidence and trust in our healthcare system.
Finley and others say expansion is crucial because the Indian Health Service is woefully underfunded. Medicaid is often the only way tribal members can pay for care. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
After centuries of overhunting by fur traders, sea otters have largely disappeared from the Oregon and Northern California coasts. But as KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the Siletz tribe is trying to bring them back with the help of a $1.5 million grant.
The three-year grant comes from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and will bolster efforts made by the Siletz and other regional tribes. Siletz tribal member Robert Kenta says sea otters have a revered role in his culture.
They figure prominently in our stories as a relative and a near neighbor, I guess. They bring wealth and good times and abundance.
Sea otters also serve an important role in the environment by eating invasive crustaceans like green crabs and by restoring and maintaining kelp forests.
There's also oxygenation and coastal erosion buffering when we have kelp forest habitat in the nearshore ecosystem. So there's lots of benefits, and we just see a degrading habitat with sea otter absence.
Kenta says the tribe and its partners will likely relocate sea otters from locations on the Pacific coast where the population is healthier. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
On Friday, New Mexico U.S. Senators Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan joined three other senators to reintroduce the Radiation Exposure Compensation Reauthorization Act, known as RECA. The program compensates Americans exposed to radiation by government nuclear programs. The Senate passed the bill last Congress, but the House of Representatives failed to pass reauthorization before its expiration deadline. Indigenous people in the Southwest are among those who've been impacted, including the Navajo Nation, where uranium mining was critical in the making of the atomic bomb. Indigenous people have been advocating for RECA's reauthorization. Last fall, members of several tribes, including the Navajo Nation, Laguna Pueblo, and Zuni Pueblo, raised funds to travel by bus from New Mexico to Washington, D.C. to urge lawmakers to revive the program. Senators Heinrich and Lujan say it's long overdue for Congress to pass RECA and say they remain committed to getting it extended and expanded. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Educators, ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org, who support this show. DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
If the federal government moves to change the name, it is an affront to our state's sovereignty.
The Alaska House of Representatives urges President Trump to keep the name Denali. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the largest crab processing facility in the country won't process the first snow crab harvest in 2 years.
We're trying to keep the hope up that fisheries will come back, but also plan for just in case they don't.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Rural Alaskans knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in their region may want to consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Council meetings serve as a forum for public involvement in federal subsistence management. Apply by Sunday, February 16th. More information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@ios.doi.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The Alaska House of Representatives today offered a rebuke to President Donald Trump's move to rename North America's highest peak as Mount McKinley. Representative Maxine Dybert, a Fairbanks Democrat, introduced the resolution. She says the name Denali has deep roots in the state's culture and identity.
Denali is more than a mountain. It's a cornerstone of Alaska's history, a tribute to our diverse culture, and a testament to the people who have cherished this land for millennia. If the federal government moves to change the name, it is an affront to our state's sovereignty.
The state of Alaska adopted the name Denali in 1975, but its name on federal maps remained Mount McKinley until the Obama administration formally changed it in 2015. The resolution passed the House 28-10 over the objections of minority Republicans. Representative Kevin McCabe, a Republican from Big Lake, argued the measure should include a message thanking Trump for another executive order rolling back Biden-era policies restricting development in the state.
Perhaps that's the best way to unite us and unite this resolution and say, hey, President Trump, thanks for doing all this. Could you possibly stop the name renaming of Denali?
Members of the largely Democratic House coalition argued that the resolution should be focused squarely on the renaming and defeated the amendment by a 21-17 margin. After the final vote, McCabe moved to allow members to reconsider their votes before the measure heads to the Senate. A final House vote is expected in coming days. The U.S. Interior Department has already started the process of changing the name back to Mount McKinley. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, a single stroke of President Trump's pen pierced the hearts of those who have called the mountain Denali for generations.
In Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare once asked, "What's in a name? Would a rose by any other name smell as sweet? Or, in this case, would a mountain by any other name be as magnificent?" At his inauguration, President Trump told us that names are a means to an end.
America will reclaim its rightful place as the greatest, most powerful, most respected nation on earth.
The president said one way to do that, change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America and do away with Denali.
And we will restore the name of a great president, William McKinley, to Mount McKinley, where it should be and where it belongs.
Pauline Carlo was in her late 90s when she performed her Denali song at the Dinakanaga Elders and Youth Conference. She had greeted President Obama with the same song when he visited Alaska in 2015. The summer, his administration changed the name back from McKinley to Denali.
Denali could What I'm saying here is Say Denali.
When it was named back to the original name of Denali, it just felt so good, and it was healing.
Angela Gonzalez remembers when Poldine sang that song for Obama. She wrote about it in her Athabascan Woman blog and the joy she felt over the return of the ancient name.
Just the feeling of a great land and untold stories from our ancestors, the relationship to the mountain and how the mountain determines the weather around the whole region.
Angela's maiden name is Yatlin, which means runner, and refers to her family's long history of trading goods.
We definitely traveled a long ways.
Where the mountain was part of a long network of trails. Denali, in her Koyukon Athabascan language, means tall one. And Denali had a family, Mount Foraker, which was originally Sultana, Denali's woman or wife, and Mount Hunter, which was Biguya, their child.
It represents something that was a part of our medicine people's trail from as far back as we know.
Wilson Justin says there are many stories about how the trails went all the way up to Siberia and Canada and all the way down the coast to California. He says in his Otna dialect, there is really no word for mountain, which were called by their names only. He was taught that the peaks covered with sparkling ice and snow were thought of as spiritual points of light.
You didn't want to refer to those places in kind of a low way or kind of a dismissive way.
Wilson remembers the old stories from his childhood with reverence.
Northern Lights are in the old stories, not the newer stories, but the really old stories of Otna are messengers. And a place like Denali being a place that messengers would like to stop and touch.
Wilson says he was taught to never act like he was entitled to the sky. For his people, Denali and its relatives were a way to connect to the universe.
When you're in that place and that location, the mountain will speak to the sky for you. A really fascinating way of indigenous people to be able to express continuity, connect to your past and future generations.
Wilson says no matter what the president calls it, Denali will always be Denali. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
This season, the Bering Sea snow crab fishery reopened after a long closure. But the country's largest crab processing facility, located in the Pribilof Islands, isn't taking any crab. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee reports on how the community is adapting to an uncertain future.
On January 15th, crabbers in the Bering Sea delivered snow crab to processors for the first time in 2 years. But not to St. Paul. Trident Seafood says the quotas are too small to justify opening its St. Paul plant, which it calls the largest crab processing plant in the world. It's also the only commercial seafood company on the island, so the decision not to reopen comes as a major blow for the town of around 400 people.
Things have been tough, but we're weathering the storm.
John Wayne Melavidoff is the president of St. Paul's tribal government, the Aleut community of St. Paul Island. They've struggled since the snow crab fishery first closed in 2022 due to a massive stock decline. The community reached a deal with UnAlaska, who agreed to process St. Paul's crab without taking their landing tax. But St. Paul is still bracing for an uncertain future.
We're trying to keep the hope up that fisheries will come back, but also plan for just in case they don't.
Melavidoff says that bracing for the possibility of no more fishing in the future means diversifying the economy. The Pribilof Islands are among the richest marine ecosystems on the planet. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration even has a permanent lab there. Melavidoff thinks they can attract more researchers to build facilities in St. Paul. The tribe opened the Bering Sea Research Center this past summer and is currently hosting scientists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
I keep saying we're working on pivoting to a research economy, but I feel like we're doing it now. We're not working on it. We're doing it.
Historically, the Pribs have remained somewhat separate from the Aleutians, a couple hundred miles south. But Melavidov stresses how important regional collaboration is. In October, he attended the Aleut Environmental Justice Working Group, a meeting between Aleutian tribes in Anchorage hosted by the Department of Energy. He says the discussion was a breath of fresh air.
We all have a lot of the same problems. We all come up with our own solutions. It would be nice to talk and just share those solutions with each other, make life a little easier for each other, right?
Among those solutions could be an increased military presence. Some regional leaders have turned to the military as a way to diversify local economies, especially as the Pentagon shows an increased interest in Alaska. The largest city in the region, Unalaska, has promoted itself as an Arctic port, encouraging the federal government to establish a larger naval presence there. Last year, St. Paul hosted a visit from the U.S. Coast Guard, which had a permanent presence on the island until 2010.
We did a potluck with them, and Admiral Fagan and Senator Sullivan said that the halibut chowder they had here was some of the best chowder they've had in the world, and they consider themselves chowder snobs.
But the region's military history is fraught. The United States government forcibly evacuated Unanga from the Pribilofs and Aleutians during World War II and forced them to live in abandoned seafood canneries where many died. Melavidov recognizes the risk of rekindling that trauma. Whatever path St. Paul takes, Melavidov says working with other communities in the region will be key. And he thinks regional events like St. Paul's growing culture camp can bring communities together too. Unalaska's summer fair has grown in recent years, and Melavidov thinks it would make an ideal gathering for towns all around the region.
We could gather again as a region and celebrate being Unungan, celebrate our culture, our language, and I really feel like we need that as a people. We need that gathering to feel complete again.
Melavidov says these connections are vital, not just for cultural preservation, but for building a stronger future for the region. In St. Paul, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, mammogram parties in Anchorage encourage women to get regular screenings.
My mom died of pancreatic cancer. My brother died of lung cancer. So cancer's huge for me. So this is my way of saying, hey, friends, let's just do it together.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The City of Delta Junction's privately owned ambulance service, Delta Medical Transport, announced it would dissolve earlier this month. That means in just under a month, residents may have to provide their own emergency transportation to Fairbanks, almost 100 miles away. As Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, the community is grasping for solutions.
Delta Medical Transport has contracted with Delta Junction for at least a decade, but for the last 2 years, the city has paid the company almost exclusively with its portion of American Rescue Act Plan, or ARPA, funding. That's the federal relief money that went out in the wake of the pandemic. Since 2021, the company's operational costs have racked up. With it, the city's EMS budget rose to over $500,000 per year. And all the while, officials never came up with a sustainable way to pay for the service. When Delta Medical Transport rescues someone, the company usually bills their insurer. The company receives about 40 calls for help per month from in and outside the Delta Junction city limits. Now, Delta Junction's ARPA funds have dried up, and the company is folding, and there's no public ambulance service in town. The owner of the company, Amber White, formally resigned at the Delta Junction City Council meeting on Tuesday. She said harassment from community members also factored into her decision to close up shop.
You as a community have refused to take initiatives and responsibility
for paying for this vital service. Anytime taxes or fees are mentioned as a possible solution toward a sustainable funding stream, you scream freedom. You scream no borough.
Delta Junction resident Sherman Stebbins is among those who are calling for safeguards against what he believes to be government overreach and extravagance. Going forward, he says he wants the city to consider less expensive options, like working with a nonprofit ambulance service or going all volunteer.
There's one group that are all beating their head against the wall, trying to find this enormous sum of money. And there's another group that would like to be a part of putting together a fiscally responsible plan. It can be done differently.
Several community members showed up to the meeting to ask city officials to find a way to sustain local EMS and to praise Delta Medical Transport for their quality of service over the years. They said they're worried about safety. They're worried about how it might impact the city's ability to host high school basketball games. And they're worried about how long it might take to replace or restore the town's emergency medical services. As it stands, Delta Junction's lone ambulance company will officially dissolve on February 21st. They'll be available to take their final calls for aid until just before midnight that night. After that, Delta Junction residents may have to drive to Fairbanks for emergency care. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Kodiak has joined the list of Alaska communities that have lost a school in recent years after its school board voted to close North Star Elementary at a special meeting last week. KMXT's Brian Benoit was there and has the story.
In the Kodiak Island Borough School District's conference room, it felt more like a funeral than a school board meeting. Not a single attendee gave public comment until after the board voted to close North Star Elementary.
I was one of those students that sat on the floor and was in the opening. We opened the doors and lit off the cannon at North Star Elementary, and I was in third grade. So it kind of hurts my heart a lot.
That's Valerie Lukeen. She's now a teacher at Maine Elementary. She was one of about a dozen community members who shared public comments near the end of the meeting.
And I just want North Star families and people to know that we are all standing behind them.
Almost everyone who talked gave similar sentiments. Some cried. The decision comes after the district held four public meetings and opened a survey for people to share their thoughts about school closure. Everyone said they didn't want to close a school, but district officials said it was running out of other ways to make ends meet after years of flat funding from the state government, and closing a school could save the district millions. While one-time funding boosts have helped, officials say they need a boost to the state's per-student education funding formula, or the base student allotment, permanently. Carrie Irons is the district's board president.
The state's inability to increase the BSA for years has led directly to this budget crisis and contributed, I believe anyway, to a whole lot of other issues we're facing as a school district, a community, and a state.
A spokesperson for the governor did not respond to requests for comment in time for this broadcast. The district has to make up an $8 million budget gap for the next school year. That's on top of millions of dollars of reductions in recent years. Iron says they decided to close North Star because it had the fewest students with addresses near the facility, as well as the low number of classrooms.
Closing a school is obviously a really drastic measure, and it's also a direct result of a budget deficit that can't reasonably be filled in any other way.
At the same meeting, the board voted to combine some grades at the town's remaining schools. For example, all of the town's kids at a single grade level will go to the same school instead of each school offering kindergarten through fifth grade. Main and East will split into upper and lower elementary schools as part of the shift. That means much of the district staff will get shuffled around before next school year. Danielle Specht is a special education teacher who taught at North Star for 17 years.
So now that this decision has been made, I want to emphasize that this truly needs to be three schools closing and two opening. I support school rebranding and ensuring that the treasured traditions of all three schools are incorporated into the restructured schools.
Kodiak now joins other major municipalities like Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau that have recently closed schools. Closing North Star is expected to make up less than half of the district's deficit, though. That means more budget cuts are likely for the schools that aren't closing. But in her closing comments, Board President Irons asked for space for North Star families to grieve.
If you're from one of those elementary school communities, please, when you think of the changes that lie ahead for you, be sensitive to the changes that the North Star community faces. Theirs is the hardest change by far, and many of their team will need support and be given the opportunity to grieve.
This isn't the end for the North Star building, though. The Board of Education also voted to keep its gym open since it's the nicest one, but the budget might not allow for that. The board still needs to present a draft budget to the Borough Assembly later this year. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The process for distributing fishery disaster relief will get some needed relief of its own. That's after former President Joe Biden signed a bill earlier this month that aims to speed up the time it takes to get disaster money into fishermen's hands. The new law is called the Fishery Improvement to Streamline Untimely Regulatory Hurdles Post-Emergency Situation Act, or simply the FISHES Act. It requires that the disaster monies be distributed to the grantees no longer than 3 months after the U.S. Secretary of Commerce receives a complete spend plan from the state. Currently, it can take years from when a fishery disaster is declared to when the money is dispersed to fishermen, processors, and affected communities. The bill was co-sponsored by both of Alaska's senators. Senator Lisa Murkowski told state legislators during a recent meeting of Alaska's Seafood Task Force that the current timeline is unacceptable.
And every secretary has said, oh, we promise to do better. Well, what we do with the FISHES Act is we have a timeline within that disaster relief needs to move through process back in Washington, D.C. It's still not the best that it could be.
Fishery disasters have happened all over the state in recent years. More recently, the Bering Sea snow crab fishery of 2023 and 24, Kuskokwim and Yukon River salmon fisheries from several years, along with the 2020 Pacific cod fishery in the Gulf of Alaska. The new law requires that the Office of Management and Budget make a decision within 30 days to either approve or deny a state spending plan once it is awarded the fishery disaster funds. Alaska has one of the lowest mammogram screening rates in the country, according to the National Cancer Institute. Mammograms help detect breast cancer and can reduce the risk of death from the disease. An imaging center in Anchorage is hoping to convince more women to get regular mammograms by changing the culture around the screenings. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra joined one of their mammogram parties and has this story.
Eight women sit in a circle eating pizza and salad and drinking wine. The evening has a bit of a book club vibe, but this is a very different type of gathering.
Hopefully everything with the screening is normal, but if there's anything that we need extra views on, ultrasound.
That's Shelly Buddy, a nurse with Imaging Associates in Anchorage. The party is in their waiting room after hours. Each woman here will take a turn going upstairs to the imaging rooms for about 20 minutes for a mammogram. That's an x-ray for breast tissue that can detect early signs of breast cancer.
If you guys have any questions about breast density or screening, I am here and happy to go over.
She wraps up the introduction and the women go back to eating their pizza and chatting.
Does anybody want one of these? Yeah.
Doreen Joyner invited 10 of her friends and coworkers to this party. Imaging Associates provides food, screenings, and usually a nurse to answer questions. They've been offering mammogram parties for at least 15 years as a way to encourage regular screenings. Joyner's been organizing them for her friends for about 8 years.
My mom died of pancreatic cancer. My brother died of lung cancer. So cancer's huge for me. So this is my way of saying, hey, friends, let's just do it together.
She says for every party, she tries to include someone who hasn't had a mammogram, but should have one. Current guidelines call for mammograms every other year for most women over 40. But in Alaska, only 60% of women are up to date with the screening. And that's partly because mammograms are uncomfortable. Buddy is new in her role as breast care coordinator for Imaging Associates. She started the job in November because she was recently diagnosed and treated for breast cancer. Buddy works after hours to host the mammogram parties a couple of times a month. But she says it's worth it because the parties can be a nudge for coworkers or friends to stay up to date. And she says she's already seen that the experience is more fun.
They typically are having a great time. They're relaxed. They're mingling with one another. Yeah, they're just having a nice, relaxing evening, despite having to get a mammogram.
Imaging Associates hosts a few mammogram parties per month across all their locations, Anchorage, Eagle River, and Palmer. There are a few other businesses in Alaska that offer similar parties, and the parties seem to be growing in popularity around the country. Caleb Duplessis focuses on breast and cervical cancer screenings for the state's Division of Public Health. They'd never heard of mammogram parties before, but they think the idea is exciting.
As humans, we don't really like to go through anything alone. And just knowing that there are other people who have been through the experience, whether that be the screening or whether that be the diagnosis or the treatment of it, that really normalizes it.
They say getting mammograms every 2 years over the age of 40 is an important way to reduce the chance of dying from breast cancer.
Early detection can lead to less treatment and less time spent in recovery for that. And it can also provide people peace of mind whenever they get a screening.
In the waiting room, Joyner passes out cookies her friend made that are decorated like breasts. She says she was really scared before her first mammogram.
I was petrified because I'd heard horrible stories about how painful it was and how embarrassing it was.
Joyner says she has breast implants, and she'd heard that makes mammograms even more uncomfortable.
And then I got it done, and I'm like, that really wasn't as bad as I thought.
Soon, she gets called upstairs to get her mammogram.
I am.
You are. If you're ready,
I'm ready.
I'm ready for you.
As long as I can take my wine.
Yes,
I
got my wine.
After her mammogram, Joyner emerges back in her clothes.
And like that, it's done. How do we get out of here this way?
A week later, Joyner found out her screening was normal. She says it was great to get the news. She's in the clear for another year until she can join her friends for the next party. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Rhonda McBride and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Theo Greenlee on St. Paul Island, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, and Brian Benoit and Davis Hovey in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us. news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Tim Rocky is our producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
IBEW's path to success includes excellent training, good wages, benefits, and a comfortable retirement. Join the IBEW and build a bright future. Call 907-575-7285 to find out more. This message sponsored by IBEW Local 1547.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning on your local public radio station.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Current is strong from what I've heard. It'll whisk you down the stream, but I never seem to have the time. So my toes just touch the water. My toes just touch the water. I daydreamed on the bank again. I was swimming with the fish. And I thought this time that it may be true. But my toes just touch the water. My toes just touch the water. My toes just touch the water. Walked a mile just to find the edge. Someplace low enough to step right in. Now I'm here, I can't begin to move.
Bitch, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, the nachos every time that you moan. Oh yeah. Is it weird that your eyes remind me of a Coldplay song?
Coldplay song.
Is it weird that I hear trumpets when you're turning me on? Is it weird that your bra remind me of a Katy Perry song?
Every time that you get undressed, I hear symphonies in my head. I wrote this song looking.
And the trumpets, they go. Oh, acapella on them. There you go. Oh, yeah.
Ah!
Virginia Woolf and poetry, no one seemed to notice me. Being young is getting so old. Cheap beer and cigarettes, life is like a movie set, and I seem to be given no role. But in times of trouble, I can turn to my mother, and I know that she gon' understand. So at age 18, I cried to my mother, and she told me, young man. There were moments when you fall to the ground, but you are stronger than you feel you are now. You don't always have to speak so loud. No, just be as you are. Life is not always a comfortable ride. Everybody's got scars that they hide, and everybody plays the fool sometimes. Yeah, just be as you are. Played me on the radio, and everything was changing, so I thought I was all the way grown. But I could still remember in that cold November when I realized I'm all alone. But in times of trouble, I can turn to my mother, and I know that she gon' understand. So at age 22, I cried to my mother, and she told me, young man. There were moments when you fall to the ground, but you were stronger than you feel you are now. You don't always have to speak so loud. No, just be as you are. It doesn't matter if you become some star. Life is better when you open your heart. You don't always have to act so hard. No, just be as you are. Fall to the ground, but you are stronger than you feel you are now. You don't always have to speak so loud. No, just be as you are. It doesn't matter if you become some star. Life is better when you open your heart. You don't always have to act so hard. No, just be as you are.
Touch the ground, touch the ground, and it feels like I can see the sands on the horizon every time you are not around. I'm slowly drifting away, wave after wave, I'm slowly drifting, and it feels like I'm drowning, pulling against the stream, pulling against the water. My feet can't touch the ground, and it feels like I can see the sands on the horizon every time you are not around. I'm slowly drifting away, wave after wave, I'm slowly drifting, and it feels like I'm drowning, pulling against the stream. Pulling against the distance keeps falling away.
makes no difference where I go. Dead in Rolling.
Health declined, I became more and more involved with her care. Over time, I realized I was becoming her sole caregiver. I wanted to support her as much as I could to ensure she was well taken care of. But over time, the stress and the exhaustion of full-time caregiving became too much. As a caregiver, I knew I was already at risk for health challenges, but I heard the Aleutian Purple Bluff Islands Association might be able to help me find respite relief. APIA supported me and my mom by enrolling us in the respite program. The program paid for a respite worker of my choosing to come in and provide me relief. With this support in place, I was able to better take care of myself. The respite worker came to my mom's apartment and cooked her dinner while I took a break. It became a way for me to recharge, rest, and ensure I was taking care of myself so I could continue to care for my mom without burning out. Caregiving is selfless and stressful at times, but APIA gave me the break I needed through the respite program.